I felt very good throughout this conference, but I feel particularly good now. I think I'm the lucky guy to get Don on the stage. I might describe myself, Don, as an ex-male chauvinist, if that's all right. I'd like to tell you quickly a very bad joke. It's not the one reason it's bad. It's not even very funny, but it's about the Middle East and should leave just about the right taste in one's mouth about certain aspects of the political scene. It seems that there was a scorpion that was, and perhaps some of you know this story, coming down to the West Bank of the Jordan and looking for a ride across. Of course, as everybody knows, I'm not sure it's true, that scorpions can't swim. It saw a frog there, so it said, Mr. Frog, would you help me across? And the frog said, well, you nuts, you'll sting me. He said, well, why would I sting you when I'm trying to get to the other side? That would be kind of stupid. We'd both drown, wouldn't we? And the frog said, well, that's logical. That makes sense. So the scorpion gets on the back of the frog, and by the time they get to the middle of the river, the frog says, well, how's everything? The scorpion says, well, I'm a little itchy, and gives him a good sting. And just before they drown, the frog said, I thought you weren't going to do that to me. We're both going to drown. And the scorpion says, well, this is the Middle East, isn't it? I don't think it's a good joke, but that'll tell. Anyway, there you are. Let me talk a little politics and then get into the investment side. Change is inevitable part and an intrinsic part of the Middle East. The name of the game there is change. This change is outwardly unpredictable and it's earth-shaking. The example of Iran and after the Shah needs no explanation. Overnight shifts in economic, political, and strategic power balances are very obvious. Future troubled spots, which we could talk about if there's time, with similar potential are Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Not in the same, not in exactly the same context, but those are obviously trouble spots as well. When you take change as inevitable and you take it for granted, then the change doesn't seem quite that unpredictable. If you're already expecting it, then that's the mode you ought to be in. The elements of change are the human factor, mainly. The increased technology that they're developing, the closer touch they are with the rest of the world, East and West, their increasing confidence and self-reliance, their determination to maintain their own culture and identity and find their own answers, not those pressed on them or taught them from outside. Those are human elements that one's got to keep in mind all the time. Any policy that depends on the maintenance of the status quo in the Middle East is going to prove disastrous. The sudden and monumental increase in influence of developments in the Middle East on the whole of the rest of the world since 1973, of course, is obvious. I maintain that the U.S., at least, has still not really begun to comprehend the implications of this fact, especially the real extent of our vulnerability due to excessive dependence on Mideast petroleum. We all know that our prices are going up, but do we really understand the implications of that dependence? I think there was some excellent discussions last night. There have been references throughout the conference to the Middle East situation. I'd like to highlight some of those. I'm not necessarily saying that I agree with every point made. We're all entitled to our own opinions. I think it was an excellent presentation, and we've got to stir up our minds. Let me suggest that the U.S. has not begun to understand the problem. It is a major blow to our economy, the implications of the Middle East rise in oil. It's a threat to our material way of life, clearly. I think maybe something that was brought out in this conference, the danger of being drawn into a major war to try to preserve oil supplies. a war we might not win, incidentally. It encourages the encouragement it provides to Soviets to take advantage of our vulnerability. The impression left with Middle Easterners, friends and foes, that we could become dangerously weak or might attempt high-risk, panicky moves in the Middle East. Another very important problem is that I think the U.S. totally underestimates the importance of the Palestine problem to its overall interests in the Middle East.
Bill, could I interrupt? Could you elaborate on exactly how the Middle Eastern countries regard America versus Russia as people to help them or antagonize them?
I think the point was brought out elsewhere in the conference. I think that Islam really is basically anti-communist. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. When you look at the various countries and how they've used the Soviets, they perhaps have used the Soviets as much as the Soviets have used them. I mean, the quick answer to your question is that they are pro-West, pro-U.S. to a man. And I would include even the Iraqis and others in this. It's a question of how you look at it. The Iraqis have used the Soviets for 15 or 20 years. I'm very familiar with the deputy foreign minister in Iraq, who said this is strictly a marriage of convenience. If you go down, the Egyptians, of course, threw out the Soviets very quickly. Does that answer your question?
Okay.
Yeah. The ever-increasing costs, energy costs, have damaged and slowed developing world economies as well, of course. It's increased the possibility of revolution, instability, and chaos disrupting the whole world as we have known it. The danger to the world financial, banking, and trade systems as we have known them. A major new factor in the 80s, though, I want to suggest, is with respect to the energy question, is the dependence, the increasing dependence of the Soviet and other communist world dependence on Middle East oil. And I think that's a factor, that's a new factor in the situation, and that raises questions. What will this bring about a U.S.-Soviet confrontation, or will it bring about cooperation? And a cooperation in that case obviously would be strictly on the basis of whether it made more sense and they're more likely to get their oil by cooperating, or whether they would, whether one is going to take a panicky move and try to take it for themselves, or take part of it for themselves. You want to keep in mind that if a major effort is made to grab it by either side, both sides may very well lose it, because the Arabs are not about to be taken over by anybody, and as they've often said, they'd rather go back to the tent than they would have somebody dominate them. I think that's a lesson for both us and the Soviets to keep in mind when we think about grabbing the oil fields. As far as the politics then of the region, I don't want to, we can come back to any of these points. How are they affected by the foregoing factors? And this touches a little on Don's point. The Middle East countries will realistically, in my opinion, accommodate to the perceived strongest power, as they always have before. You look at the history, and of course it makes sense from their point of view. They're militarily weak. In the long run, the Mideast countries will be able to maintain their own identity, culture, and probably political independence. That's a matter of waiting it out till whoever's strong power gets weak, and they always have in the past. They eventually will again, I suppose. In the short run, of course, they could be controlled, or important parts of the Middle East could be controlled by elements friendly to the Soviets. And given our continuing irresponsible dependence on Middle East oil, this obviously could prove disastrous to the U.S. Now, just to rapidly mention the Iranian situation, obviously vulnerable to the Soviets, as we've heard during the conference. If, however, it's kept out of Soviet hands, in other words, if it's just kind of in the middle mishmash that it is now, it's probably not too devastating in and of itself, because we're not critically dependent on Iranian oil. Saudi Arabia, of course, is highly concerned with the question of encirclement. encirclement from the Horn of Africa, where the Soviets are well ensconced, to the disruptions in Iran, to the problems in Afghanistan. These are critical and disturbing points to the Saudi regime. They're concerned about South Yemen, of course, and any kind of radicalization. And just as a quick side note, one of the main points about Palestine that people need to understand is that from our point of view, it's very important that the Arabs feel that something is being done about the problem. Now, why aren't they doing it themselves? Of course, they should do more, and that's fine. But to the extent that the Palestinian problem is not being resolved, it tends to radicalize the area, obviously, because if you are not doing enough, quote-unquote, to suit the activist elements, obviously you're under pressure. If you're doing too much, quote-unquote, then you're likely to get yourself in trouble with the United States, which has all kinds of domestic hang-ups about the Palestinian question. It's a very tricky one, and what happens to that Palestinian question is important. It could very well be one of the major factors that radicalizes the area, and I think that's a very important additional point to the question of what the Soviets are going to do there. We may find, we should watch out for the Soviets, but we may very well find out that other rats are in the cheese. And I just want to make that point. It's not just the Soviets that could cause us problems there. I referred to Egypt as a potential powder keg. When you have I think Sadat is fantastic. I don't like to think of, and he apparently is trying to move into a more democratic mood, or mode. His mood probably is not. But you take the Shah is one man, and when he goes overnight, the situation changes there. What happens, just let your mind run for a minute, what happens if Sadat were suddenly to leave the scene? Probably it's not a totally equal situation, but I always get nervous when you have only one man running the show. Obviously, this whole Middle East situation adds up to a very tricky proposition for any investor. The business activity, let's take two sides. One is investments going that way by us, and the other one is coming, of course, them coming over here, which my company is more concerned with as kind of a practical matter. But we can talk about both. And also it's the difference between whether a government is investing or whether private individuals are investing, and that's another matter. That's slightly different. The business activity in the Middle East up to now, of course, has been largely the preserve of the foreign economic or the international economic giants like Mobil and Bechtel and Chase. Western vehicles for investment are largely lacking in the Middle East countries. That's to say, there are no public stock markets. They have their own curb exchanges, but they're not open to foreign participation. Foreigners generally may not own real estate in those countries. It tends to boil down really to foreign participation in joint ventures of various sorts, where our companies obtain partners out there and go into various lines of business. The possibilities for smaller size investments are fantastic there. And the problem is, obviously, one of economics and of psychology. I mean, that's a long way away. There are political problems. One is concerned whether about his investment, obviously. I mean, it's not a climate that immediately strikes you as a good place to invest. It's the big guys who can manage that can survive. From the economic point of view, of course, if you're small, you're not going to spend the money to $5,000 or more round trip for a week or so to go and see what's going on out there. Just economically, it doesn't make too much sense for small individuals to go into it. But there is a tremendous market for The other point, of course, is that a lot of money is there, and that's not a bad reason for going somewhere. So that's really a very strong balancing factor. But what's really going to get something rolling in that area will probably be a little further down the line when groups get together, when a few individuals would say, look, we'd like to, we'll pool our 100 or 200,000, and if we find something that's in a million or 2 million, 3 million, 5 million range, and we feel happy enough about it, and we see that there is something there where we can, that gives you a little bit of money to work with while you're developing something. I think the...
Bill?
Yeah?
Does either your company, or do you know of any companies that are actually doing this already?
There have been a couple of very interesting efforts made by Saudis. Mohammed bin Abdulaziz was the former minister, I guess you'd call him, for saline waters and for electricity in the country. He's left that now, and he was developing an Islamic fund. Now that fund is not open to foreigners to invest in, but it's the kind of sort of mutual fund or something that we're talking about here. I don't want to overemphasize. It's a long shot. It's the kind of thing that is coming because there's a need for smaller services and there's a need for people who are doing those things that come just below the multi-billion-dollar highways and the infrastructure and all that. Naturally, the next step down is what? Maintenance and keeping up the services of this infrastructure. The next stage is other kinds of fast foods and they like everything American. Whether it's food or cars or the way we do things, that is it there. There's a tremendous market. Now, the question is how you do it so that you aren't encouraging somebody down a path where it's risky. It's high risk. Okay, but I think there's a heck of a market for that, and our company, and I'm sure others, are constantly listening to see whether there might be some area there that... That could be some to break into that a little bit. Obviously, I think what you can see from my rather prejudiced point of view, I declare myself as having a bias and a prejudice the way our Australian friend did earlier about Australia. I'm very optimistic about the Middle East, and the way I look at it, when people ask me what the risks are, I say, well, if it's burn, baby, burn in Watts, are you going to invest in the Watts area of Los Angeles or even in Los Angeles at all while that's going on? However, would you say that Los Angeles was not a place to invest in? So obviously timing is terribly important and knowledge is very important, but it's all there if the proper knowledge is there. That's what's going to make it pop, knowledge and timing.
Bill, as time is running, could we jump now to where the Arabs are going with their money?
Well, all right. Shall I give a profile of an Arab investor, or shall
just give you a
more general?
No, give us a profile of the Arab investor, and then basically where their money is going.
All right. This is just the way I look at it. If you see an average Arab investor, he's probably around 40 or less than 40 years of age. He's been educated in the United States, in Europe, or possibly in Cairo. That's sort of second class to have done that in Cairo. He probably has an emancipated wife. He's probably an ex-chauvinist, too. Who's often foreign. Who's educating his children, their children, abroad. He's the son of a prominent figure who's accumulated wealth either through service to a previous ruler or was from a traditionally wealthy trading family. He's therefore basically wealthy by birth. He models himself on an American businessman entrepreneur, energetic, broad-gauged interest, peripatetic, optimistic, shrewd. But he's basically very, very cautious. He's slow to make up his mind. He tends to lean on banks sometimes to our sorrow, rather than investment banks. Probably he's a very sensible guy. They are very, very sensitive to anti-Arab feelings in the United States, and this is a crucial factor. Partly because he senses his lack of knowledge in new environments, he's understandably uncomfortable and feels an advantage, at a disadvantage. He instinctively believes in caveat emptor. Obviously, he's a curious mixture of conservatism and recklessness. He wants guarantees of profits, quote unquote. On the other hand, he wants to leverage high leverage. He shuns venture capital deals, preferring early built-in returns, but he wants big profits. He likes to gamble at the gambling tables, but this proclivity does not carry over into business situations. Like Americans, he wants to deal with the top man in any organization, but unfortunately is vulnerable to influence peddlers. And if you think we're not overseas, I guess that's a subject that shouldn't be discussed too much around the authorities. He's spoiled in the sense of enjoying and being accustomed to every sort of backing from his own government, and therefore he often feels more comfortable with Europeans, Japanese, and others, rather than us who are more exposed. He prefers tangible assets and asset-rich situations, especially real estate, rather than investments in engineering firms, those with heavy R&D, those that depend on the human factor more. He wants an equity partner tied into a deal with his own money. He generally represents a group of investors rather than operating solely on his own. He wants diversification. He fundamentally prefers investing at home and feels more comfortable there, but looks for where the bucks are. I think if you think of this overall, that the Arab investor emerges is not too different from any other wealthy investor from the West. He is capitalist and conservative through and through. The way of doing business with Arab investors, therefore, is, in a nutshell, is to treat him as you would any investor you have known. Some are easy, some are difficult, some are smart, some are not. What you want to keep in mind is his background, his predilections, his concerns, his different culture. But in human reaction terms, you'll find him similar to yourself. I think what question was asked, what about the Arabs' reaction to gold versus other investments? I think they come out basically where we do. Where the situation looks as though you have a good, solid investment in something that, and you can sit on it and feel comfortable with it, and it's in the ground, is fine. If you feel as though you might have to make some quick moves someplace, then you tend to look for the precious metals. I don't see that there's one iota of difference between their reaction to things generally and our reaction to things. I want to make one more interesting point. I specifically asked the ruler of Kuwait's investment advisor, who's a very close friend of mine. I see a lot of him. His son goes to school in Princeton. I said, Khalid, what is your reaction to what the Arabs will do about gold in the future? He said, my calculation is that during the last run-up of gold, the Arabs, and he says, Ma'al Asaf, that means unfortunately, he's not a gold bug himself. He doesn't believe that his government should be dealing a lot in gold per se, I mean as a government. He said, my calculation is that the total Arab input into that was about two-fifths. About 40% of the action in gold was probably comes from Arab petro countries. And he said, that's big stuff, but that's not a controlling. And we don't consider that we control the markets. We don't consider that we control the gold any more than we do the other factors. As far as investing with Arabs is concerned, Don, I really will shut up after this. There are a number of parts of the world that when you're looking for other parts of the world to do investments in, I'd like to suggest that you look north-south as well as east-west. I think we have real potential in Mexico and in Canada. I think those are countries with tremendous possibilities for us. And when you do that and you want some big buck backers, BBB, that's pretty good. Don't forget the Arabs. And don't forget that some of us know what they're doing and what they want to do. They are very good partners, not only because they've got the bucks, because they like to learn, they like to do the things the way we do. And I think you would find that if you found some interesting things, either here or abroad, and that you put your bucks into, so they know that you're up front on this, that they'll prove to be very good partners with a lot of money and a lot of interest in learning. I have one commercial, and that is I wrote a letter to the New York Times, which is printed. I have a few copies outside, and if anyone's interested, I suggest they pick that up. If somebody, if it runs out or something, someone wants to leave a name on a piece of sheet of paper just saying, I'm so-and-so, I'll send you a copy. I think that gives you something about what I think is the potential of North America. Lastly, there is another article there on Persian Gulf security, which I think is a very balanced view. It's not too different than what was said last night, but it has some. I think those who are interested in that part of the world should look at that.
Thank you, Bill. As I'm sitting up here, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to get my question in first before I start on the audience. This may be impossible to answer, but you can try. With this profile of an Arab investor that you outlined, can you hypothetically give on a percentage basis where his portfolio would be? For example, 20% in T-bills, 10% in gold, this type of thing.
As far as an individual is concerned, I would say that it kind of moves back and forth. There was a time when they thought the stock market was a good investment, and I think they will again. I think, again, they feel the way we do, that, you know, it's kind of a tricky thing. Do I really want to do it or not? They have a predilection for the stock market. They like that kind of gambling, if you want to call it partly that. They would have a certain amount in real estate. They have a very strong view that they want to have as much back home as possible. So I would say that, and it depends a lot on each one. I mean, the average one today is wants his assets fairly close to him back in his country, but is constantly realizing that he really ought to do something in the other part of the world. And it's a learning exercise, it's a learning exercise. It's not just a matter of investing your money somewhere else for a better return, because their returns in their own country are generally much higher. But it's a learning process, and they're constantly wanting to learn. I would say well over 50% in their own countries, Don, maybe 40% in real estate and 20% in the stock market. I mean, if one wanted to make a wild guess.
Next question. I've heard that the Arabs were buying large amounts of gold without going over the open market, presumably meaning that it wouldn't affect the open market price. Is this true? Do you know anything about it?
I don't really know that. It's interesting to talk to gold people here at this conference. I mean, there's some fabulous gold experts here, but there's so much that's not known about gold. I think it's absolutely fascinating. There's just where the gold is and who's got it. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
This question, you have my permission to say no comment. What position do you think the U.S. should take with regard to Israel?
My view on that is perfectly, obviously, because it's mine, it's perfectly straightforward. I like to look at it from the U.S. viewpoint. I think if you stick to the U.S. interest, rather than deciding whether you're pro-Israeli or pro-Arab, you're going to be okay. What is the U.S. interest? The U.S. interest is to have stable and growing, not stable, stable change. You understand, I don't believe anything stands still. I don't think that the Israeli regimes of up to now, over the past 30 years, have taken sufficiently into consideration where they are and what is required as basic gut decisions to get the kind of security that will be in their own best interest. And I don't think that supporting the Israeli side because it'll help you get elected in the States, I don't. That's crudely put. It's not that's not the way I would have put it a few years ago when I was a diplomat, but I don't see how you get around the fact that it has become a domestic issue in this country and a question of election. And there is nothing that gets you in more difficulty if you start saying, well, is Israel right or are the Arabs right? I mean, they're both right and they're both wrong. And there's absolutely that's a no-win question. The question is, what is the U.S. interest? The U.S. interest is the flow of oil from there. The U.S. interest is in human beings not being eliminated and being tortured and being terrorized. And I'm talking about Jew and Arab, aren't I? I mean, the Jews have been victimized in recent years. 30 years ago, it was people like Menachem Begin himself, who was the terrorist and who had to do with the explosion at the King David Hotel. I don't see what's the point of blaming a man like that for that now? The foreign minister is supposed to be an ex-terrorist. When and if the Palestinians ever have a state, and I think they should, and I think that's the way the problem's going to be solved, they will have ex-terrorists as well. And I hope they're as responsible in preserving and helping their own countries as their own country as Menachem Begin and the others have in Israel. I have nothing but the greatest respect for Israel and how it's under incredible circumstances has managed to survive. I don't think that our role, and I don't blame an Israeli for anything he's done so far, to preserve himself. Anyone has a right to preserve his own hide. I blame very much the United States government for not understanding its own interests well enough to know where to plug in your assistance and what sort of assistance you should be providing that doesn't affect your other interests. We have human interests, we have oil interests, we have strategic interests. We're all uptight about the Soviets out there now. The fact of the matter is that our Middle East policy in general is very much to be blamed for the position we're in today and for the Soviet menace as well as the rats in the cheese, some other rats in the cheese that I spoke of. And I think that is something the American people, I would like to join Harry in what his message was, but also to add mine that we need to look and learn more about what's going on in that lifeline. And as long as it's a lifeline to us, we jolly well better know what our interests are. When and if we ever get off this criminal dependence on that oil in that area, all of us have spent all of our lives knowing that the oil was running out. I don't think there's anyone older than me in this room, but in the old days, we learned when I was a kid, we only had, 15 to 30 years of oil supplies, and I remember learning that in a school book. I mean, we have, and that's in the Middle Ages that I was doing that. That's 40 years ago. And we're saying that that we have a problem with dependence on oil. I mean, it doesn't make, I don't consider that a responsible approach. The fascinating part is the Arabs don't think that's a sensible approach either. Do you realize, and they realize certainly, that they could make hundreds and hundreds of dollars more per barrel if that oil was sold as products rather than as energy? They have no more interest in selling oil to us as energy than we have paying those bills. When you look at the chemistry of a barrel of oil and realize what the products are, of that barrel of oil, it's a criminal waste to use it as energy. And that's something that the Arabs understand, and when we understand it and we get to a less dependence through our coal or through whatever it is, we're going to go on having a magnificent relationship with those guys, and we're going to use our oil in a better way, and so will they.